G'day and welcome to the Sod's Law podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Rosenberg, and this is the last podcast that will highlight ordinary people and their extraordinary stories. Last? Well, what do you mean, Dan? This is episode 149. You said that the last ever Sod's Pod would be episode 150. Well, yes, I did, but that will not be a standard episode. It will not fit within the standard format. So in terms of intro ramble, then an interview with a lovely guest, this is it, folks. This is the last one. Next week's will be different entirely from any of the previous 149. So if you don't want to miss it, make sure you come back from Monday the 31st of October. But for now, our final guest of the podcast is an English comedian, presenter, screenwriter, author, and self-described Jewish atheist who, as well as being a co-writer of the de facto anthem of English football, has written a highly acclaimed book that largely highlights the double standards extensively employed, either knowingly or unknowingly, by anti-racists when dealing with anti-Semitism. It's a really special treat, but it wouldn't be Sod's Law if we jumped right in, would it? So let's warm up a little bit first. So I've tried to time this in a particular way. We knew that we'd be ending Sod's Law a few months ago, but I was adamant that we wait for 150, not just because it's a nice big old round number, but because the date of release, 31st of October 2022, is exactly 3 years on from my first ever podcast recording with a guest. The first time I sat down with someone and asked them questions about their life and story, their trajectory, with a microphone between us. It was my old school pal, OK and Zalu. He had just released his debut novel, and I did my research to make sure I could respect the time that he was giving me by recording with me. I remember sitting in my car outside his house. It had been about 18 months, 2 years in the making, planning with Victoria what the podcast was going to be about. I had a pad with questions written out longhand just to make sure I could be as professional as possible. And I was absolutely shitting myself, terrified that I couldn't do it, terrified I'd do a crappy job, terrified that people would listen to whatever I released and think it was shit. So I called Victoria from the car, expressed my worries, and she told me it was all going to be great. Dan, you've done your homework. You talk to people all the time. The only difference now is that there will be a microphone in the room capturing that conversation. And she helped me get over that fear of failure. The first time in my adult life that I hadn't been so scared to fail that I hadn't bothered to try. And so I knock on OK's door, he invites me in, we sit down, we have our chat. I refer to my notes, pull up sections of his novel that were particularly interesting to me. And we talked for about 45 minutes. I thank him for his time, he thanks me too, and I leave. So I get back in my car and I am physically shaking. Not just that, I'm sweating, I stink of BO, and I don't ever recall being that nervous before, even when speaking in front of a room full of people. So I drive home, I put the SD card from the H2N handy mic that I used for the chat into my laptop, and I give it to Vic to have a listen. And you know what? After all of that fear, all of that apprehension, all of that panic, all of the dread, wanting to quit or bury my head in the sand, I'd done it, guys. I'd planned and prepared and conquered my fear of failure. I was now a podcaster. I'd breached the boundaries of my own crippling self-loathing and anxiety to create one of the worst podcast episodes ever bloody recorded. The entire conversation was filled with mumbled, despite carefully prepared questions, cringeworthy nervous laughter, and my guest's extremely interesting, well-presented life story was blocked out by my handling the microphone too much, the sound of me mouth-breathing like an overbred bulldog with emphysema and a deviated septum. And it was really upsetting. But Victoria pulled me up by my bootstraps and said, just do it better next time and bloody make sure that there's a next time. So we booked OK and again, and we did it better. And each time I spoke to a different person on the mics, I would learn how to do things better. I would make different mistakes and then learn from those mistakes and then get better and trying it better and trying it better. And early on, when I was stressing just about releasing an episode a week, there were some conversations that maybe I wouldn't have recorded now, but I still learned from them. And here's something I don't think I've revealed on here before. Yes, this is episode 149, but I have recorded quite a few more than that number. If you put to one side the 9 bonus episodes I recorded in Poland with Ukrainian refugee stories, there are also a further 20 or so that I've never released. That's over 10% of the conversations I've recorded that I did such a bad job of and then wasn't able to get another chance to record. But each of those unreleased episodes, despite technical issues, me being a rubbish interviewer, or even being asked not to release the conversation by the guests themselves, I got something positive out of every single one. For half of the 3 years we've been doing this, outside of the podcast, in real life, we didn't get to see real life human people in the flesh due to COVID. So recording these conversations was my access to the outside world. I guess I have the pandemic to thank for that, because I never wanted to record Zoom or remote interviews before the lockdowns. I turned my nose up at podcasts that did that. But now I get to look back on 150 conversations with people, 2/3 of which I'd never have had the chance to interact with if not for the bloody pandemic. I've learned about cultures, history, individual or collective experiences direct from the source. Do you know how lucky that makes me? I learned about the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami that killed 250,000 people from one of the people who survived it. I learned about what it was like to be a part of the Kinder transport and then to lose your entire family from someone who went through it themselves. I learned what it was like to be smuggled out of Iran as a child, what it was like to literally hunt Nazis for a living, what it was like to become the super welterweight champion of the world from these remote conversations. How many people get the chance to do that? And what about the intros? Because at the beginning, when we first started, they were terrible. So robotic, inauthentic. And I purposely didn't want to talk too much about me because I thought that the listeners weren't going to find what I had to say interesting. They would want the guest, and anything I say has to be contextually relevant if I say anything at all. And right away, I was proven wrong by people writing in saying I should put more of myself into the podcast. And so I didn't actually start talking about myself in these monologues till around episode 9, where I referenced, without context, that I hated birds, specifically parakeets. And from there, I got a barrage of requests to clarify as to why. And I told the parakeet story in episode 11. And from then on, every week, there was a rant, a current affairs ramble, a silly story about parenting, talking about mental health. And then that, outside of the guest interviews, took on a life of its own. I started opening up, started formulating and voicing opinions on all sorts of topics. And they garnered their own audience, separate from the people who came to listen to whichever guest was on the podcast each week. These intro monologues, like this one, gave me the opportunity to sit down every week, write out some ideas, gave me the chance to really delve deep into my own sense of self, edit, cut, move things around, and then spew them out into the world. And the guest interviews, I feel like have made me a better person, but I think the intro monologues made me more content with just being me. People wanted to hear what I had to say on some things. I wasn't just presenting an interesting person to the world framed through my line of questioning or conversation. My ideas were being well received for the first time in my life, even if they weren't fully formed, even if they weren't all good ideas. The openness and the honesty of laying yourself bare on a public platform, well, the response to that was and still is overwhelming to me. And don't get me wrong, there's a huge difference between being open about mental health or fertility or bereavement and being fragile or self-deprecating in a woe is me, I'm expressing how shit I am so people tell me how not shit I am kind of way. But it wasn't all great. We got a lot of exposure at one point. We went a little bit viral. Yeah. But that virility was something that I hadn't anticipated and I didn't deal with it very well. And what came out of that was ego. Very separate from self-esteem or self-worth. And granted, I always had a bit of an ego. But when you go viral or get a lot of exposure for being angry about something, which happened with me, people engage with that anger and in turn expect more anger from you. And the adulation you get for being angry feeds your ego and you want more. So you give out more anger and more people engage. And then the majority of people you see engaging are living angrily through you or vicariously through your anger. And so I became, for quite a few weeks, that guy who had a hot take on things and expressed his angry opinions that, whilst maybe not unjustified, weren't the reason why we set up this podcast in the first place. And I started to focus more on producing clips and content from the intros than I would do on the guest interviews, and chasing that ego, that adulation, that leads to entitlement, can lead to ruthlessness. And thank God I've got people in my life who are able to see that and call me on it before it consumed me. And also, for most of the last 3 years, I viewed my being open about dark shit on here as being my therapy. It made me feel good to be open about my failures, my shortcomings. But on an episode only a couple of weeks ago featuring Stuart Goldsmith, he talked about the idea of being so brutally honest on stage or on a podcast, whilst it makes you feel good because of the response to your openness or perceived authenticity, that response, that adulation, papers over the symptoms, but completely ignores the pathology or the gaping open wound. So when the podcast is over, or when you don't get the response you want to being open, you don't feel good, you feel fucking awful. Maybe you feel worse for having been open. I mean, that in my case, I tied my self-worth, my self-esteem, or a part of my reason for being to a fucking podcast. What I had done was chase the painkiller by being brutally open, being rageful, maybe, but I didn't think to do the exercises or the hard work to fix the cause of the pain in the first place, didn't pay attention to the fact that my self-worth is inherent. I have value whether someone is listening or not. And that realization was profound. It made me incredibly grateful for the opportunity to create this whole thing, but then showed me that there was life beyond it too. That this podcast wasn't something to do once a week, every week, until I died or somehow became incapacitated in some way. But it was a thing that had a start and an end. It's a creation that at some point you complete. So whilst there are a limitless number of people I still like to talk to and plenty of ideas I could still share or stories I could tell, I get to round off Sod's Law at 150 like a complete work of art. And I'm calling it art. It might not be the best work of art in the world. You might say it could be better, or there's more that could be added, but there's always more that could be added, and you can drive yourself absolutely bonkers, adding and adding and adding. But that's one of the beautiful things about art, isn't it? By its very definition, it's subjective. What it means to me could be completely different to what it means to you or the person stood next to you looking at or listening to it at the same time, even in the same way. And for so long, I thought that true art or a true creative endeavor doesn't really exist until you release it into the world, that it required engagement with a listener or a consumer or a viewer. But that's just not true. This podcast has been made of exactly what Victoria and I wanted it to be made of in the way we wanted to make it. And isn't that all that matters? That we're happy with it, that we're proud of it. Sod's Law has grown and changed and adapted and adjusted over the last 3 years. And we now get to just add the finishing touches, close the lid, seal it tight, and sit back and go, oh, all of that time and all of that energy we put into it, all of those hours spent piecing it together, just the two of us, it was all worth it. And I'm fucking proud of that. This week, I'm talking with David Baddiel. If you're not familiar with David, he's an English comedian, presenter, screenwriter and author known for different things to different people. For the last 30 plus years, if it wasn't his regular appearances on top UK comedy shows like Taskmaster or 8 out of 10 Cats, or growing up reading his incredible children's books, or drunkenly singing Three Lions on the Shirt anytime there's a whiff of the England football team winning a match, you couldn't not be aware of some aspect of David's work whilst living in the UK. More recently, though, David's become even more internationally known for his book Jews Don't Count, that highlights the double standards extensively employed by anti-racists or progressives when dealing with anti-Semitism. So here's a brief context to this conversation. I've been trying to speak to David for quite a while. I reached out a year or so ago and heard nothing back. I reached out again recently and was told by his people, very politely, no, thank you, it's not going to work. And then in September, a month ago, David was doing a week-long run at the Lowry Theatre in Salford, near me, putting on a live conversation about Jews Don't Count, featuring readings from the book and more. So Vic and I got some tickets and we popped along. We got the chance to ask David a few questions directly during the show. And afterwards, he was signing some books. We queued up with everybody else. And when it was our turn, he was particularly complimentary about some of our questions. And so we had him exactly where we wanted him, face to face in front of a room full of people where it would have been really bloody awkward to turn us down. So I asked him to do the podcast and he agreed. He would do a 30-minute chat with me before the next night's show. So due to the time constraints, we got right into it. Not really playing to the normal format, but god damn, was this a good conversation. On my list of dream people to chat with, David was right at the very top. So this was an even more profound pleasure than normal for me, and what a bloody good way to top it all off. So without any further chatter from me, here's my conversation with David Baddiel. Without headphones, I didn't really want you to have to stretch all the way over.
That's fine.
So, probably the most time-limited podcast I've ever done so far, but that's not a problem because I've worked out what I want to talk to you about. And by the way, the background noise is clearly going to be part of the context.
Yeah, we're in my dressing room. Well, a dressing room backstage where I'm doing a show at the Lowry based on my book. So that's all Atmos as far as I'm concerned. Although, fucking shut up now. Right, there you go.
So last night I came to see you and it was wonderful.
Thank you.
I'm not trying to blow smoke up your ass, but it was fascinating and I did have to stop myself from constantly raising my hand up and asking questions. But instead of delving into your background, which is what I would normally do initially, I'd like to ask you some questions that I hope you haven't yet been asked. Not just around Jews Don't Count, but around aspects of your life when it comes to being a public Jew. Hmm. I've revisited the book today, both audio and physical. And what I think I want to start off with is asking, well, let's refer to one bit where you're talking about, I called it last night, being, was it a Jew of prominence? You are. It's part of your public persona. It's not something you've ever hidden from. When was it in your career, if it wasn't just inherent in your entire life, where you made that decision, I'm going to be publicly Jew?
It was inherent. I've always talked, before I was a public figure, about being Jewish. It's always been a very intrinsic part of who I am. I had, you know, a very Jewish upbringing, kind of more Jewish maybe than people realise, in that I went to a very Jewish primary school, an Orthodox Jewish primary school, the North West London Jewish primary school. I wore tzitzit and a couple every day. Mm. I learnt Hebrew. I said blessings because of that, although my background at home was not that. Mm. My background at home was not that. But I think that fixed something in me quite unusual, because like when I left that school, I briefly had a kind of panic attack on the realization that the rest of the world was not Jewish. And I started going to cheder and Hebrew classes and whatever. But then I stopped doing that because I thought, no, I don't want to do that, because I very quickly realized I was an atheist, yeah, even at that age. And but I think the experience of being there and at Habonim, where I went to, and the fact that most of my parents' friends were Jewish, when I had the shock, which comes to perhaps all Jews who've had that kind of upbringing, that the world is generally not Jewish and possibly even quite antagonistic towards Jews, it was too late. Mm. It had been fixed in me that Jew was actually the default. Mm. Not, that's not correct, but that's what my subconscious thought and maybe still thinks. And so therefore, I never felt any kind of discomfort. It would never occur to me to feel any kind of discomfort by talking about being Jewish. There is an answer, there is a kind of sort of different answer to your question, which is, so I was always that. I was always like open and just talking as much about being, and like, even when I was in like Cambridge Footlights, where I was one of the first people that probably was the first person to do stand-up comedy rather than character comedy and sketches on Cambridge Footlights. In my in the show that I was in, the Cambridge Footlights, I did some stand-up about being Jewish. But the difference, I guess, the moment at which I kind of maybe made any kind of decision, not sure it really was a decision or whatever, was, I guess, in the last kind of sort of 5 or 6 or maybe longer years, when I shifted up a gear, in, I guess, in terms of the Jewiness of my persona, in reaction to what I saw as anti-Semitism on the net, anti-Semitism growing elsewhere, and what the book is about, which is the failure of the progressive left to take in that and do something about it and respond to it seriously. So at that point, I would say I put Jewishness a bit further forward in my personality. But even then, it wasn't that much of a conscious decision. It was just something I felt.
So growing up in a similar regard, even though I grew up in Manchester, an avid hater of football, I grew up with this pride around being a Jew, culturally and to some extent religiously, until that went away. I wouldn't say I'm an atheist, I'm more agnostic in this weird wishy-washy way, but the point being, there was an element of being proud of who I was and a fear of antagonism, but I was never given any tools to deal with that other than my dad and my uncle, who were like, well, if someone's racist towards you, smack him, or no, don't be the first, be the one to finish it type mentality. But that doesn't equip young people or anybody who is subjected to Jew hatred or anti-Semitism with any tools or resources to be able to fight back in any way. When did that start happening to you? Where did you get your resources from? Because there's one thing to be going, I know what I am, I'm proud of what I am, or I won't be ashamed of what I am, which is, I think, a difference between pride and being unashamed.
Well, yeah, I know you tweeted me about that. We can talk about that.
I don't know if that was me who tweeted.
Was that not you?
There was another person yesterday who asked a question about it.
Oh, okay. I thought that was you.
No, I don't.
You're Daniel, right?
I am Daniel.
Okay, he's also called Daniel. That was my confusion.
I know Daniel. He emailed me this morning saying, what did you think of my thing?
But, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, different.
Because in my mind, because I know you had, we should maybe talk about it. It's still an interesting point. Raised, which was, he said, I enjoyed it last night, but I felt, I mean, I don't know if you wanted to talk about this right now, but
this was going to come up.
Okay, so I'll just say it now and you can edit it how you like, but he said this thing about, I think that not being ashamed is too low a bar and we should be proud of our Jewish values. And that isn't exactly how I think about it. That's sort of like just, you know, it's fine, obviously, to be proud of being Jewish, but I don't sort of think about it in those terms, in that binary. I don't think not being ashamed is that different from being proud or whatever. And I can talk about that later if you want.
We'll come back to it, because I do have some questions about that. So we're talking about, where did you start going, oh, this is what I have to do, or who gave you the tools and resources to be able to write a book such as this? Because this is a tool book for people like me.
Right. I think it's not just for people like you, obviously. I think the book is a... Sarah Silverman, who I interviewed for the documentary about it, described it, she was worried about using this word, but actually I think it's a good word, as a kind of gas, she said, that sort of around in the air that all Jews feel, and I'd sort of brought it into a sort of, shape, that all Jews had felt this slight sense of which, like, what's going on in terms of the way that we're sort of left out of this conversation, we're left out of conversation about racism, when racism happens to us, people don't seem to take it seriously, and she said lots and lots of Jewish people feel that, but no one had sort of packaged it in the way that I had. But I think that most Jews read the book and think, yeah, right? Whereas I think in terms of it being a toolkit, it's supposed to be a toolkit for the, I think I referred to this last night, to the progressive man who is non-Jewish, who thinks of himself as an anti-racist, but reads the book and then writes to me and says, oh, you're right, I do feel some of these things. I hadn't thought of them as being anti-Semitic. And then he said anti-Semitism turns out to be the racism that sneaks past you. And what the book is, I guess, is a bulwark against that, or a primer to help you spot it sneaking past you, right? And that's all to do with the way that anti-Semitism is, because as you know, anti-Semitism is a more complex, more elusive, often more subconscious racism than others, which can be much more sort of manifestly kind of sort of acted on, I think. Not that there aren't ways in which those are unconscious as well. Anyway, I don't know. I mean, who gave me the tools is a really complicated question, because, I am someone who, for better or worse, operates almost entirely in tune with whatever I feel at the time. I don't think in terms of like, this is what I want to do in my career now. I think it'd be good. Like, even like I wrote children's books because I had children and because I was telling them stories, not because I thought this is a good career move or whatever. Similarly with this, I was asked to write an essay book by the Times Literary Supplement. They said, you can be about anything. And I instantly said, well, I want to write it about the leaving out of anti-Semitism and Jewish identity from the present identity politics conversation. And I just knew that's what I want to write about because it's something that I'd really noticed and that felt very at the front of my soul.
That's interesting, though, because timeline-wise, this came out 2021, so you're writing it 2020, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
So it, I think in my head, I was just having a peek through, and I think there's notes at the end written in August 2020.
Well, the coda written on the day of Corbyn's suspension from the Labour Party, that's the coda, which is October 2020, I think.
Maybe October. Yeah. So the reason why I ask is the whole Jewish fear of Corbyn being Prime Minister was 2019.
Yeah.
If you'd have been contacted by TLS in 2014, 2005, would you have written something like this, or would it have been whatever was going on in your head at the time?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I'd written this, no, because unquestionably, to some extent, the feeling to write something quite so polemical and quite so extensive was to do with Corbyn and the Labour Party and that experience. However, the first time I wrote an article about something I talked about last night, the Y word, the chanting of the Y word at Chelsea and the way that it was being ignored. And in its own way, you know, I don't know, you're not a football fan, but if you experience
I'm
that...
I'm aware of it. Yeah.
Okay, if you experience that, it's much more extreme than anything that happened with the Labour Party.
I actually made a note to bring this up,
right,
where you're talking about going to a football match with your brother.
Yeah.
And he turns around and tells the person to fuck off or shut up.
A man is saying, fuck the Jews, fuck the fucking Jews, fuck the Yids, over and over again.
Yeah. And he responds by eventually shutting up.
Yeah.
But then your brother says, like, I feel like I'm going to cry now.
Yeah.
And this comes on to Jewish pride in that...
So I just think, Phil, I should answer your question, though, which is...
Sorry.
The question, the reason I brought that up is I wrote an article in The Independent, I think it was, about the chanting of the Y word in 2002. So, and I wrote then about the fact that this was happening in a culture that was meant to be moving against racism, but no one was talking about it. So I had the feelings and the sense that something was not going right in terms of, you know, awareness of Jewish offence in that back then. But no, I don't know if I could have written quite this book then.
So the reason why I say on the topic of Jewish pride, because Daniel Burke, who spoke up last night and has subsequently tweeted at you, I know him personally, I've actually had him on this podcast because he's a lawyer and involved in a number of different charities. And so Jewish Pride is a book
by Ben Freeman.
So I've read it. It's a great book.
Yeah.
I want to know your opinion on the concept.
I haven't read it.
Well, I'll pitch to you the concept. Hopefully I'll get it right, Ben, whereby he says anti-Semitism is, or dealing with anti-Semitism is not the Jews' problem. It's the anti-Semites' problem. The Jew's responsibility is to have pride in oneself, one's people, what have you, Jewish pride. And that's the point of the book, Jewish Pride, Rebuilding a People. Based on what we were saying before, the difference between pride and not being ashamed, how do you feel about something like that? Because I think that's what Daniel Burke was referring
to. Well, I got the impression that Daniel Burke, who I thought was you, was like taking me to task on that. I'm sorry, by the way, Ben Freeman has sent me his book and I should have read it, but I have a big pile of books that people sent me.
Yeah.
Firstly, I'm talking about something specific, right? Very intellectually specific in the book, which is the anti-racist conversation and the leaving of Jews out in that conversation. And I would say encountering that, it makes more sense to talk about Jews having a lack of shame.
Yeah.
Because I think that the issue of whether Jews should be proud of Jewish values, which maybe they should, or whatever, or talk about Jewish achievement, or whatever, that seems to me, yeah, fine, Jews can do that. But that seems to me to be a different corner of the room to the conversation of, like, if we're going to say to woke people, to people who are allies and all the rest of it, you seem to be leaving us out, then I think we need to be unashamed about being Jews, and we need to be unashamed about calling out anti-Semitism. But that's not quite the same as being proud of Jewish achievement. Do you see?
I mean,
it feels to me like a different thing.
Yeah, I understand that.
And that's what I'm focused on in Jews Don't Count. And so I don't quite agree that, you know, that sets a low bar, because, which is what that guy Daniel Burke said to me, because I just think that's the tool, that's the primary tool to some extent that Jews have to have. They need to be not afraid to say we deserve the same protections, strictures, respect as you're granting to other minorities in the way that you're changing, you, the progressive left, are changing the way that people used to think about minorities, which is obviously full of stereotypes and race and whatever. We have to be able to say we are not happy that you're not doing this for Jews, but that seems to me to not really be about, say, you know, I don't really, to be honest, I don't really know what Jewish pride is, but say Jewish pride is, if it's a much more sort of like tangible thing, like, okay, we're really proud of the fact that we have, like I think I said last night, 22% of Nobel Prize winners are Jews, because despite us being 0.001 of global population, great, well done Jews, you know, hooray. But I don't think that's important.
But
that's not important in the anti-racist conversation.
No, well, saying, oh, well, look how many Nobel Prize winners there are is a generalisation, same as all Jews are rich, all Jews are this. All Jews are Nobel. It's not the case. And I can't claim responsibility for a Nobel Prize, just as I'm not responsible for a Jewish person committing some kind of crime.
No, I agree with that. Although I do think that, and this is sort of completely not part of my conversation, I do think that, that's complex, because I think that Jews can be proud, if they want, of other Jews doing well. You know, in a minority, one of the things about being in a minority, like I said yesterday, that one of the things that is very annoying about having this notion that we have to apologize for Israel or for whatever, you know, I see, you know, people essentially deciding that because of Harvey Weinstein and Epstein or whatever, that Jews sort of have to apologize for this kind of collective responsibility thing, right? That therefore the idea that you should have collective responsibility for something good, which is what you're saying, is equally invalid. But at the same time,
it's like, not about collective responsibility, it's about taking ownership. So for example, someone like Jeffrey Epstein or Harvey Weinstein, if we look at other communities that have had members of their community who have committed sins or aberrations, what typically happens is they renounce that person and they say, they're not one of us. But what they should really be doing is going, they're a fucking dickhead, we should have done more, we'll try and make sure that doesn't happen again. Same as if someone is an open member of a community, such as a Jewish community, and a member of that community does something wrong, you shouldn't hide from the fact that there is an element of responsibility, but you don't take ownership of their behaviour.
Yeah, but this is a very minority thing, as I say, because what I was going to answer is I said last night about how Christians, white Christians, don't feel any need to say apologize for Putin, who is a white Christian and actually in his own mind acting in the name of white Christianity. He's trying to restore his own version of the Holy Russian Empire, right? But no white Christian has ever felt the need, because they're the majority, so they don't identify in that way. But it's just a fact of human nature, you know, that you know, that you end up thinking quite fondly of a member of your community who's like a great person. You know, black people are proud of Nelson Mandela, and that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. I'm conscious of time.
Yeah.
How are we doing? We've got some time. We're doing okay. I thought we were rushing through. So last night, one of the questions I asked was about, like, what can we do? How can we deal with this differently? I would assume that the majority of people who consume this book, Jews Don't Count, are Jews, or like you said, progressive people who think they're doing the right thing, which essentially means you're preaching to the choir.
No, I don't agree with that. Sorry.
So let me finish that statement and tell me more about your disagreement with me. I would assume, and I'm happy to be told I'm wrong, being that I think, from my maybe limited perspective, that media created to talk about things like anti-Semitism, to say this is how we fight anti-Semitism, are not generally consumed by the people who really make up the majority of the groups waving the flags in the marches that we would say that's anti-Semitic, but don't realize they're anti-Semitic. It's consumed by the people who mostly already agree with you. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, because there are two different things that you said there. You said it's consumed by Jews, and I would agree with you that most Jews agree with the book, probably, and the book for them is an articulation of something they already felt. So that is, to some extent, preaching to the converted, or I would say it's, as I say, articulating something for the people who are in didn't realize how converted they were to this idea. I don't agree with you about progressives, though. The book is primarily it's a critique. And there's been much pushback on it, even though there have been other people who have sort of accepted at least some of the arguments, but there's been much pushback from people who, you know, are just won't have critiques of progressives. You're so convinced that progressives are always on the right side of history and always essentially the goodies, that the idea that there might be a flaw in the way that they think is just sort of unconscionable for them. So they're not, I'm not preaching to converted. If any of those, and the guy who reads the book and says, oh, I basically thought, you know, everything I believe in my bones was always anti-racist. I've read your book and some of the attitudes you're talking about are blah, blah, blah. Sorry not to say it again, but it turns out the anti-Semitism is the racism that sneaks past you. That speaks entirely of a person who has been converted but was not beforehand.
Maybe I'm coming at this with a very cynical mind in that from my limited experience, whether that's within a Twitter sphere or social media or work life, most people who purport to be wanting to be on the inverted commas right side of history, Jews don't count in that regard. And so I would think, well, they're not going to want to consume this because in their head, Jews don't count.
No, well, obviously, that's the battle I'm fighting. Mm. And the point I'm fighting is, all I can tell you is, right, I don't know, the book sold like 150,000 copies. I'm sure the bigger percentage of that is Jews. But I also know that from social media, I get a lot, I mean, not nothing, I get a lot of tweets from people who absolutely consider themselves to be part of what you've just described and who've read the book and it's given them pause. Mm. That's the point. And that's all I would expect and hope for, that they have read the book and they've thought, oh, I hadn't really thought of it like this. And specifically about the Corbyn years. Yeah. Specifically, these are people who, during the Corbyn years, at the very least, because they're probably not the fucking terrible element of that, at the very least there are people who thought, I don't really get it, what's this all about? Surely a left-wing person can't be racist, basically, as simple as that. And they've looked at it and they thought, oh, I get it, you have to sort of understand racism slightly differently.
Yeah.
You have to understand it as a series of absences rather than just people saying I hate Jews.
I've pitched this question to a number of people. I've talked extensively about the marriage between right-wing and left-wing anti-Semitism almost behind the back. How can we, as in me, as just a normal schmo, read Jews Don't Count, take away or an understanding of the double standards or the hypocrisy and go, right, I'm now going to stand up and make a difference, but isn't an angry way or an aggressive way, but just go like, this is going to have an impact in my life. How do we take that and use it as a tool?
Well, you asked me a question yesterday in the show, and you said, like, you're a prominent Jew, but how can we, you know, not so prominent Jews make a difference? But actually, you've got, it turns out, I didn't know this when asking the question, you've got a podcast.
Yeah, but most of the people in the room don't.
No, that's true. But I mean, I'm not suggesting everyone does a podcast, but I am suggesting that, you know, there are multiple ways now to get your voice out there. You know, it sounds to me like you've got your voice out there in quite a big way, as it turns out. And I'm not suggesting that everyone has to be incredibly successful in doing that, but we do have. That's one reason why we live in the world we do now, where I felt I needed to write this book, is that we now live in a babel of voices, right? And it seemed to me that the babel of voices was ignoring Jews, or to some extent, you know, more than that, being negative about Jews, and there was no other voice. There was not. Where was the voice of, like, response to that? So my point being, it's not just social media, but the internet does allow people to say what they think much more. And you can't, you know, if you want to speak out about this, then you don't have to be silent. But I guess this comes back to the point about shame and embarrassment and all the rest of it, because I do think an awful lot of Jews still, and the book has empowered some of them, like every night, I get people saying, oh, you know, I've had this at work, or I had this in my local community where someone used to say this, and I read your book, and now I've decided to go and talk to them, and I've given it to my friends, and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I don't want to overstate it, but I am pleased. I am proud. If I'm proud about anything, it's that I hear people saying the book's making a difference.
I think another reason for my cynicism is that because I was not a prominent person, I became more prominent because of this, because of talking about this in a similar way to you do. I hadn't read your book until after my platform had grown.
Yeah.
But part of my question last night was, you have, in a beneficial way, utilized your platform, even though you've been talking about it for years, to talk about this. But I am, despite my best efforts, known for talking about anti-Semitism, but that's not all I am. Yeah. I am a Jew.
Yeah.
I never, whether I wanted to or not, I am I couldn't change that. But I'm also like 17 other things. Mm. I'm also a dad. I'm also a runner. I'm also whatever. Most people still want their own interests that aren't just, well, just you. How do people come to terms with that if they do raise their head above the parapet and take that chance? Because it is a risk.
Yeah.
How do they continue to exist in the real world? Because the Jewish world isn't the real world, it's a part of the real world.
Yeah. No, that's the problem, I think. I feel that problem to some extent because, you know, I've done this and it's been successful and I'm pleased about it and I'm, you know, as I say, kind of proud about it. Proud is not really a word I use very much, but, you know, I'm happy that it's shifted the dial maybe a tiny bit in the conversation. Mm. But here's the problem is that, and actually to some extent, that's not a problem with Jewishness. That's a problem with the way the world works. And the way the world works is if something hits, right, even if your podcast is a bit successful or that book is successful, then people think that's what that person is. Mm. Because, you know, we're not meant to know all these people, right? We're meant to know about four people in our lives. Yeah. So if we know thousands of people because of this, you tag them very quickly with the thing you know about them. And if the thing you know about them is he's a guy on a podcast who talks about being Jewish, or he's the guy who writes that book, then that's what you become. And if you want to break out of that and say, no, I'm many other things, which of course you are, I, or whatever, it can be quite difficult. Mm. And at the moment, I'm getting like hundreds of offers and requests to do Jewish stuff. And I'll do some of it. But actually yesterday, I was offered quite a big thing. I just said, no, you know what? I want the next thing that I do not to be about Jews. Mm.
That leads to my next question, which is, considering this has taken up far more of your creative time than maybe another project might have done, considering it's now a year or so on, what's next? If you're able to talk about it, this run that you're on that I've come to see you at, that we're in the Lowry Theatre, is a week or so at the Lowry to have a conversation with you about this book.
Yeah.
But once this is over, what next?
Well, I'm doing a documentary. I'm editing it at the moment. It's being edited. I'm now here, so I'm editing it remotely. So that will come out and there'll be a fallout from that. It's on Channel 4. It's with Louis Theroux's production company. It seems to be going well and they seem to be giving it quite a lot of prominence, but it will definitely create quite a lot of noise when it's out. So I'll be out there talking about that or whatever. This actual show was partly an experiment because I literally just chat to an audience about the ideas in the book, do a couple of readings, whatever, hear their stories. And I quite enjoyed it. So I might do a few more of these in London and wherever. But I do want to move on. And so I don't know. I'm getting quite a lot of people wanting me to write a book called Jews Still Don't Count, a sort of follow-up. I don't really know. I mean, even though there are other things to say, of course. There's always other things to say about this conversation. I don't know if I want to do that. I don't know. I'm not going to do it because I might decide I do need to do it. Mm. It's difficult. It's particularly difficult, I think, at the moment, because one of the problems with identity politics is that you can get, you know, very quickly boxed into your identity. And part of the problems for Jews, I would say, is that, like, it's not an identity that is bought or owned by the culture much. Mm. So that's partly seems to be what I'm doing as well. It's like I'm saying, no, you know, if people want to be, you know, this is my identity and it's to some extent about my sexuality or my ethnicity or whatever, why can't Jew be that identity, part of it? And that's complicated if you then say, but actually, I don't want to just be that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. In terms of what I'm doing next, beyond that, I'm doing a musical based on my first children's book, which is, the music's being written by Dan Gillespie-Sells, who wrote Everyone's Talking About Jamie.
Yeah.
He's brilliant. He's amazing. I'm writing the book. And I think we're workshopping that at the end of the year, and hopefully it'll be on next year. So that's kind of my next big project.
Amazing.
And I've written a book about atheism.
Huh. Before we go, I've got one more question. You'll see I've brought a copy of The Secret Purposes, only in that I'd never heard of it until last night. I've only read the first few pages.
Okay, just say about the first few pages. I mean, you'll probably like it, I think, because you're a very man who clearly thinks very deeply about Jewishness. The first 30 pages are like a prologue, and they seem almost Talmudic, right? It's a rabbi walking around a city with seven bridges, Königsberg, which is where my grandfather was from, and each bridge he thinks about a different sin, one of the seven deadly sins, and contemplates it, and it's incredibly philosophical or whatever. And then after that, it becomes more of a big old story. So don't be put off.
There is a reason, and it's because last night you made a statement about how this book, 2005, I think it came out, and I'd never heard of it before. I knew about your children's books, I knew about other work that you'd done, But the story of Jews being interned on the Isle of Man is something that I turned to Victoria, my wife, who was sitting next to me, said, "How the fuck have we not heard about this?"
Yeah.
So buy this book. It's still available on Amazon.
Yeah, give us a brief overview. I mean, I was making a point, not just plugging the book.
No, no, but this is... The reason why I bring it up is because you were talking about going to see it in a bookshop and it was put with
Well, in the book I say, I'm talking about how it was in the Jewish interest section in Waterstones. And I said, my point is that it's part of the marginalisation, the weird marginalisation of Jews, that we are not considered, or our cultural products are not considered kind of British exactly. Mm. You know, this is about a part of British history, the internment of Jewish German refugees on the Isle of Man during the Second World War. Fucking hell, no one knows about that. It's an incredibly interesting part of British history, but it's kind of in this weird subsection of like, oh, that's kind of a Jewish thing. Mm. And so therefore, unlike other minorities, unlike, I would say, White Teeth or Brick Lane or all sorts of other, you know, important stuff by minority writers, which becomes great British writing, Jewish writing feels like, you know, well, that's kind of at one side.
Yeah.
So that's my point about The Secret Purposes. So I'm glad you bought it anyway.
Yeah, well, I'm going to read it this weekend.
Great.
My kids are driving. Abandon my parenting responsibilities to read a book. Thank you so much for taking the time to
do pleasure, this. Daniel. I'm glad you're not... Well, hey, if you're listening, I like the other Daniel as well. But, you know, I'm glad you're not him.
There we go. Thank you for joining us this week. I hope you enjoyed my chat with David. Sod's Law is available to listen to wherever you get podcasts and in full video on the Sod's Pod YouTube channel. So go ahead and click subscribe or follow so you don't miss any of our final episodes. If you want to contact us about any of our episodes so far, you can drop us an email to pod@sodspod.com or visit our website, sodspod.com. If you're on social media, you can find updates, episode clips and more with the handles @DanielMRosenberg and @SodsPod. Make sure you have a fantastic day, and thanks for listening.